everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Jaffardini. Thank you oh so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Man, I would say the best thing about being a fan of cinema or video games or pop culture is the fact that you get to take stuff home with you. When you go to the theater, sometimes it stays on the silver screen. When you see it on your, you know, your TV and an 8-bit controller, stuff is stuck in the ephemera that is the pixels that make the visual world of Super Mario Brothers intangible and untouchable. But as a fan of music, you can take that home with you. You put it in your car, your phone, your vinyl player, your mini disc player, whatever it is. These things live in your DNA because the stuff, you play these games 60, 70, 90 hours. I mean, I can't get through something in less than 4 weeks. GTA 3, going back to you in college. Anyway, I'm rambling beyond belief, but we are incredibly humbled and enthralled to speak to our next guest, Wilbert Roget II, esteemed composer, collaborator, soundsmith, musical wizard. He's dipped his toes in waters you wouldn't believe. Tomb Raider, Mortal Kombat, Star Wars, Call of Duty. I bet he's got stuff that we don't even know about, stuff he's cooking up in his kitchen. So I'm gonna get off this incredibly long-winded introduction and give the mic over to the man, the myth, the legend, the guy who makes your dreams come true and makes your ears pop, Wilbert Roget II. Welcome to the podcast. How are things in your world?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you. Great to be here.
Incredibly humble man. But we got a lot to speak to. I also forgot to mention Gundam. Gosh, it's like you have a wealth of riches at your fingertips. A multi-instrumentalist, a man of many skills and talents. Will, let's go back to the very, very beginning. Where did it all start for you? What was your origin story? What was start on the controller of your life that said, I got to get into music and I'm not looking back?
Well, I started with classical piano when I was probably like 3 or 4. I have this theory that I was a very annoying child. And so my parents kept lying about my age so that they could just get rid of me and send me off to a piano teacher for like an hour. I started that very early. After maybe middle school, high school, that era when I was a teenager, I kind of started being a little bit disillusioned with just playing classical piano. I wanted to do something else. But I was kind of too young to understand what that something else was until I started playing video games. We didn't really have consoles at home, but it was always like, you know, every time we were at the shopping mall, I would run off to the arcade or something. Well, finally, I got like a PlayStation and I played Final Fantasy VII. And that's really the game that said like, no, you want to write music, not just play it. And this is what music you're going to write. You're going to write, at the time it was the Japanese role-playing game style, but I became obsessed with it all throughout high school. And I wrote stuff on my own. I did tons of transcription of video game music. And I also joined, you know, through the internet back then when it was like IRC, I joined as many sort of indie projects as I could to just get some experience writing for video games. And then finally I went to college and I majored in music and joined the Game Audio Network Guild after college while still doing more indie projects. Met some of the right people who became friends with me to this day. And our careers kind of grew up with each other in tandem. And through that connection, I eventually ended up at LucasArts as a music assistant and music editor and implementer. And I was there for 5 years until the Disney buyout and the studio shutdown. But in that time, I'd sort of risen in the ranks and become a music supervisor, like assistant music supervisor and music composer as well. And eventually, once it shut down, I started my freelance career. And that basically started with mobile games and eventually Lara Croft and the Temple of Osiris. And then gradually more titles and more titles, and things kind of kept snowballing. And now here I am.
You're not just juggling balls, you're juggling boulders. I mean, like, that is a lot to unpack. Let's talk about two things specifically. Transcribing music, was that you just saying, hey, here's what I think, this is my interpretation of these notes? And then when you talk about music supervision at LucasArts, my impression from a cinematic aspect is spotting and getting the rights to music, but those are source cues. So how does that work in the world of LucasArts? And then go back to the transcriptions. Let's l learn more about Will.
Yeah, sure. So remember, this was like, we're talking 1999, 1998. And say you have a video game and you love the music from this game. Well, there's really only two ways to hear that music outside of the game. One is to import the $50 CD from Japan.
Done that. I've
And
done that.
yeah, I mean, it's a, so have I. However, the other way that most people did was they would find the MIDI file that some basement-dwelling nerd had painstakingly transcribed note for note from the game. And I was one of those basement-dwelling nerds. I would get to the part of the game that, I really liked the music. I would record it with my cassette player. I think probably like taking the little aux cable or whatever from the game out to the tape or whatever you call those RCA to eighth inch cables. And yeah, record a little bit, get the loop point, and then just keep playing the cassette tape until I figured out every single part. I think this is probably where I learned composition. It's the best training, I think, that exists for learning composition because, unlike score study, which I consider to be somewhat passive, you're actively going to every single part and not just understanding what the composer did, but why they made those decisions. You'll grasp that because you are taking it down note for note rather than it just being like, oh, here's all the parts, and it's just there for me already fully digested. So that's kind of why I did the transcriptions, and it was just a lot of fun. Remember, back then it was a lot easier because game music was usually on these at that era it was on these early sample, real-time sample sets. So for example, Super Nintendo, they only had what, eight channels for music, meaning eight possible note polyphony. PlayStation had 24, I believe, but that's still quite limited. Whereas now it's much more difficult because obviously we can use like a full orchestra or a fully produced piece or whatever we want. So it's a little trickier to get into transcription now, but at the time that was the perfect way to get into it. Skipping ahead about music supervision. So that term does get thrown around a lot in games, and it means different thing depending on what company. When I use it, what I mean is that I would be the person, and I'm talking about games like I think Monkey Island 2 Special Edition and Star Wars, the unreleased Star Wars First Assault are the titles where I would have considered myself music supervisor. What that means in those cases is that you are the person who designs the interactive systems, or in the case of Monkey Island, kind of redesigns, because it already had a brilliant interactive system created in the 90s. But you design how music works, you spot the game, which means just like it does in film, you decide like, oh, music should play here, and then it should transition to this, and so on. And then to some degree, you're responsible for the resources that go into it. So for both titles, I was responsible for budgeting for whichever players. On First Assault, we did hire the London Symphony Orchestra at Abbey Road. And so I
Jeez.
had to budget for that and figure out orchestration costs and whom to hire for everything. And then on Monkey Island, it was a little trickier because we had to basically do the same level of quality as the first special edition Monkey Island, but in half the time and half the budget, and with 10 times as much music. And also, it had to be interactive. So it was like, okay, well, this is going to take, the craziest budgeting skill that I probably have ever done with stretching something out for such a lengthy, such a considerable ask, shall we say. But that's sort of the music supervisor's role. And then I was also the composer on Star Wars First Assault. So I was dealing with that as well, setting up the interactive system, but then also writing within it and iterating upon the system so that it was exactly how we wanted in the end.
When I was 96, I think, I got this LucasArts 5-pack game that came on disc, little 3.5 discs. And so it was Indiana Jones: The Last Crusade, Maniac Mansion, Loom, Monkey Island, and just the diversity of those games, even on the similar engineering and mechanics. They were so wildly different. The music was amazing. I mean, Loom was derivative of Swan Lake, so there was you had to work with that source material. But when it came to whether you took John Williams' Last Crusade music or Maniac Mansion, like these things were became their own animals and just an infinitely replayable and a lot of fun for that aspect. Where I'm going with this is LucasArts has a way of sucking people in, both at the consumer level. So on the creation level, I can only imagine that you just had probably an effing blast. I mean, Rebel Assault, you're talking about First Assault. I would go back to Rebel Assault. That was so much fun. And then you think of things like Shadows of the Empire score, Joel McNeely's to the score to the book, and then the video game. There is no question there. I just wanted to be like, I couldn't wait to just be like, Will, you're so awesome. You touched on these things that I've loved my whole life. So,
Oh,
that's really all it is.
you know what? It's funny, like you mentioned these titles last week or maybe the week before. I was just in Los Angeles for Game Sound Con, which is it probably my favorite video game conference of the year now. And it's exactly what it sounds like. It's composers and sound designers, voice directors and actors and audio programmers from basically across the world convening in Los Angeles for 2 days in order to present talks and lectures, but then also hang out and catch up. And I got to hang out with Peter McConnell, who is one of the classic composers for Monkey Island and Grim Fandango, of course,
Yeah.
and later on Psychonauts. And George, the Fat Man Sanger, who I think he was I know he was on one of the classic or some of the classic LucasArts adventure games. I'm thinking Maniac Mansion, he contributed to that one. Possibly Loom. I'll have to look it up. But it was just so great. And then also some other people who are on the team on the sound side of the classic LucasArts eras. And it was just so cool to reconnect with them and just hear their stories once again and see what they're up to. They're still very active in the industry, and of course Peter McConnell is one of the greatest American game composers like ever. So it's always great to spend time with our roots, shall we say.
Well, what were some of your entry points into video game music being more than just beeps and boops coming out of the TV or whatever? Because the one that did it for me, I mean, sure, I've never beaten Super Mario Brothers. My friends are still beating me up to this day. But Chip 'n Dale Rescue Rangers, there's a theme at the last level that I thought so much of it, I tried to record it. Now, dumbass fifth grade me, I pressed record on a tape player. Well, that's for dubbing. So I didn't understand the aspects of like how it was like, if you want to do a tape to tape recording, it didn't record. It wasn't a microphone recording. So at 10 years old, I had more road to go to understand what acoustics and sound engineering was like. All that said, it was like one of those things like, yes, this is doing something for me. And I can only imagine that people who composed it, granted the chiptune limitations are di I mean, even if you had symphony funneled into chip tune, you could still make it sound impacting and emotional. So, all that said, what was your entry point? What was the one that you were like, this is there's something to this. This like really feels like home to me.
Yeah, it's funny, like now that I'm remembering a little bit more clearly, I did play a lot of Mortal Kombat back in middle school.
Like
And
96, I think, maybe.
whenever I think it was, I can't remember when exactly, I think Mortal Kombat 2 was just on the horizon, but I was playing Mortal Kombat 1 in the arcade, and that was my first like video game experience that really captured me. Introducing me to like video games, but also like the martial arts. I became so obsessed in middle school, as every boy was really back then. And eventually the movies came out and all that. But the funny thing is that I didn't, somehow it didn't occur to me that it was possible to write music for video games. For some reason back then, it was just like, oh yeah, you play the game and then the music magically just kind of happens and whatever. Same with, I was playing, eventually I got a Game Boy and I was playing Mario 6 Golden Coins, I guess, and then whatever the Kirby game was on Game Boy. And I could play on the piano any piece of music that I'd heard on Mortal Kombat, on like the Kirby game, on Mario, or whatever, just from memory and quite easily, in fact. It was just like, oh yeah, here you go, here's the music. And it never occurred to me that like a series of human beings actually wrote this music. And for some reason, it was once I played Final Fantasy VII that that clicked. That like, no, people wrote this. And you can too. You know, there's nothing stopping you. And that's kind of where it all came together. And the really funny thing about this, and the reason why I brought up Mortal Kombat, is that like Mortal Kombat was such a part of my life, like so integral to like everything I was doing. You know, I was obsessed with Mortal Kombat 3 on PC for all of high school. And eventually I became more of a 3D fighting game player, like Virtua Fighter and Tekken, but MK3 was like an every single day kind of thing, obsession. And it didn't occur to me until after Mortal Kombat 10 that no, you can just call them up and say, I would like to write music for Mortal Kombat. Like, it didn't occur to me that like mortal humans were allowed to write this music. And I'm still, you know, I was obsessed with like Dan Fortnum's music style, and I was borrowing a lot of that. Even for my Lara Croft scores. But it never occurred to me that like, no, you can just email them, which I did, and say like, hey, I'm interested. Do you have anything? So yeah, it's weird how video game music just seems like so integral to the art that you just don't even consider that no, there's people who are making this. It's just so tightly intertwined.
Well, your approach reminded me of a story I heard about Ramin Djawadi, who just literally knocked on Hans Zimmer's door and was like, "Hey, are you hiring? I'd like to do something." And sure, come on in, or whatever Hans sounds like. But I was just having this second brain tangent. Like, I think we could create a podcast called Mortal Compositions with a K. And just talk about, love of the medium and the sound. Totally not going to go anywhere. I've always had these failed business models. But when I'm thinking of composers, I mean, like I remember speaking to Michael Giacchino a long time ago, and he kind of got the is it the Call of Duty, or, well, you worked on Call of Duty, but I don't remember if that was one of his first projects. But it was the
It
idea
was. He
that
did
he
both. He started off both Call of Duty and Medal of Honor, actually.
That's the one I'm thinking about, Medal of Honor. But he said famously, he's like, I don't play video games, because he's terrible at it. So sometimes you do need to get in the head of the player to kind of see what works for you. Sometimes you don't. What is the Roger approach to working in soundscapes?
Well, I mean, that's the funny thing is that we have that luxury. I think that to some degree, as a film composer or just anyone working in linear, you are speaking to the audience to some degree. But I think that as a game composer, you're speaking more directly to them. You can even comment on the game as you are composing for it. For instance, in my Lara Croft score, I had the luxury of getting a PC from the developers so that I could implement the score myself however I felt like it. And I'm playing through it and I'm not using cheats or anything, so I have to go through the same struggles as the players if it's like a different difficult combat area or a difficult elaborate puzzle. And I could just say, hey, look at, you know, this room, the puzzle is very hard. So maybe instead of continuing the default level music that we would have for the full area, I'll switch the music to like a separate piece that I'd written for tricky puzzles, just to maybe subconsciously encourage the player and let them know, hey, look at everyone is having trouble with this room. Everyone is having trouble. Don't worry, just think it through. The answer is probably more complicated than you think. You may have to go through a lot of steps. But we use music as a hint, almost like as a pep talk to encourage the player to just keep at it and not get discouraged. You don't really have that in film necessarily. You don't necessarily, I mean, you're aware of the audience's emotional state, but it's more a reflection of the characters that are in the film rather than the player who is a part of like creating the story. In games, we have that dialogue, and it can influence your implementation as well as your arrangement. You can have, for instance, the whole idea of interactive music for combat, where you're saying like, "Hey, look at there's difficult enemies here, so maybe we have like bigger, stronger sounding music, and then or maybe these enemies are just cannon fodder, so the music will be stripped down." But you have that that dynamic in games that in film, it's more about what's happening on the screen rather than anything that the viewer is participating in.
Well, I mean, it's like it's the mentality that with a film, it's passive, because you're experiencing it visually and not doing anything. But you bring up the idea of the A theme and the B theme to sort of, interweave and maybe heighten when things are crazy, or like you said, maybe encourage players. How complex can it get? How complex have you made it to where we got an A, we need a B, we need a J, because, stuff's getting crazy.
Well, I mean, I think that the implementation systems should always serve the content. So it always kind of depends. I mean, I worked on Destiny 2 Forsaken, and the music system they have for that series is incredibly complicated. But it's so fluent and it comes together so well in real time that players probably don't even notice the interactive stuff going on. They just hear, Mike Salvatore and Sky Lewin's beautiful music, and then they're just like, oh, okay, yeah, this is awesome. But and the rest of course, the Destiny composers, there's like 10 of them. But on the flip side, you have games like Monkey Island 2 Special Edition, for instance, and the original Monkey Island 2, where the implementation is so integral to the game design that it almost becomes a part of the fun. Like the very first, or one of the very first areas in Monkey Island 2, it's a town called Woodtick. And they set up a system, Clint Bajakian and Peter McConnell and Michael Land. They have this system, and I think Michael Land wrote this area. It's a system where there's a main kind of thoroughfare, there's a main sort of chord progression, shall we say, when you're outside. And then as soon as you go into any of the rooms, so like you can go talk to the cartographer, or you can go to the kitchen, or the hotel, or whatever you want to go to, then a solo instrument will start playing and it'll have a melody. And depending on what measure that the melody ends, like if you leave the room, it'll have a unique transition so that the melody always sounds like it's naturally ended rather than being cut short.
Oh, perfect.
This meant that there were something like 200 transitions for that area alone, because they had to take care of every single possible measure that this could have ended. I remember I was at the Game Developers Conference in 2007, where I first met Michael Land, and we were having dinner with a bunch of other LucasArts folks before I got hired at LucasArts, actually. And he was telling me about the system that he'd constructed for Woodtick and how he had to do all these transitions, but it was such a great system. And I just thought to myself, wow, that's so cool. I hope I never have to do anything remotely like that. That is so inordinately complicated. Why would anyone do that? And of course, 2, 3 years later, not only did I have to do that and recreate it, but we did it with live instruments as well. And we had to do a huge amount of chicanery in order to make sure that even though it was live instruments, we could still get all 200 or whatever of those transitions, which was not easy. But
Doesn't sound like it.
yeah, but that's kind of like the two extremes of one is like the implementation is so complex but also so intertwined into the game that it becomes a part of the fun, and then another implementation where it's still complicated but it's used almost cinematically, so you intentionally don't notice. It just feels natural for the game.
Sure. Well, I love the level of detail, because it's like, I mean, I'm in a creative industry, so a lot of things we do is stuff that the general public or the consumer may probably never pick up on, but it's one of those things where when it feels seamless and intuitive, it's right. It feels organic and like it was planned that way from the beginning, even if it took, 12 months to get right. But there was, I'm gonna dog something right now. There was a A game from a little-known sci-fi adventure from the 70s. You may have heard of it. It was a mobile game, and there got to be a part where there was a level, let's just say it rhymes with Cloud City. And what it did is it put the music of the asteroid chase in a, like a gun battle. And there was no way to tail it off before the, you know, even if you were still in action, it would be a very, very impacting theme from a movie, but it had no way to sort of find an in and out, and it just felt so disjointed. Now, I dog on that only because that's a good example of when you notice something not feeling right. So, I mean, the music was great, but it just didn't time up with what was happening. The other point, why don't we jump use that as a jumping off point to talk about Star Wars Outlaws? How much fun is that going to be? Raise your hands if you're excited to talk about Star Wars Outlaws. Yay! I had such a fun time with this. Now, I have not played one second of gameplay, but your music stirred in me things that I didn't think were possible. Because with as many things canonical, off to Outer Rim in the Star Wars universe, there was something about this that just said, this guy gets it. But it definitely, you feel like a melting pot because I think you're probably 7 to 15 tracks in before you actually start to get to the John Williams French horns, those things that make it feel contiguous with the universe. I mean, I think the third track is Canto Bight. So what you're doing is you're going into expanded universe territory. It feels like you're aware of things like the Mandalorian and those sounds that Ludwig Göransson came up with. Whether or not it was inferred or influenced, it was its own animal. And then when you get to the meat and potatoes, I mean, I'm just gonna jump to track number 14, Leaving Jaunta's Hope. And then my personal favorite is The Broken Hoof. You did things that put this knocked it out of the park. So let's use that as a grapefruit. What was your entry point? How do you do your magic? And why is this so effing awesome?
Well, first of all, thank you. The Outlaws is one of my favorite projects that I've ever worked on. And I think that the reason why is because, at the point where they reached out to me and asked, like, hey, are you interested in this? Would you like to do a demo for this? I was kind of finished with Star Wars. I just thought, like, well, I've already done projects like Vader Immortal, which was a lot of fun to write for, but it just felt like, well, I'm kind of just, bargain basement John Williams here. I'm like, it's not really my own music that I'm writing. I'm just sort of having fun emulating another composer. But I've done that already, and I could do more scores like that, but it would sort of be a little bit of a waste of time because I'm not really developing my own sound. I'm just sort of trying my best to emulate. And so I was ready to say, like, eh, no thanks. Thanks for considering me, but maybe hire someone else, get someone fresh for this. But the Ubisoft team actually told me straight up, like, no, actually, we want something new. We want something that can make our game unique. This is a unique opportunity. We've never had like an open world shooter Star Wars before. And we want something that makes it, that has that sort of Ubisoft tradition of, this is music that can live outside of the game in addition to working very much interactively with the game. And so I thought, all right, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to go all the way. I'm not going to tiptoe in this. And if you don't want to hire me, that's absolutely fine as well. So I did Kay's theme. That was actually my demo piece. And as you know, that piece doesn't go into any orchestration at all until maybe a solid minute in. And instead, it has a lot of musical sound design. It's got the distorted bass. It's got like some world instruments as well and the electric violin. It has basically everything that you would not associate with Star Wars to start it off. But it was much more in line with the Ubisoft sort of musical heritage of these smaller ensembles and use of electronics and a modern take on video game music. They're always very cutting edge like that. And so I wanted to put that forward. And then gradually bring in the Star Wars isms, gradually work our way into the orchestra, the heroic sort of, brass and all that. And I said, well, here it is. Kind of take it or leave it. I will not compromise. So, whatever you want to do, I will be happy to stay with you or to leave it alone. And within 45 minutes, I mean, I quite honestly, almost immediately, I heard back from the audio director saying, "This is exactly what we want. Stay tuned. We have to talk to a bunch of people, but I think that this is exactly what the game has needed this entire time." And they demoed with other composers, but I think that later on he explained to me that the fact that I was using solo instruments and blending as seamlessly as I possibly could between the modern elements and the synthesis and whatnot, and the Star Wars elements like the orchestra, as if they were just a part of a single whole. That's what he wanted. That's what they needed, and they didn't even know to ask for it, but it was just in line with what I wanted to do as a composer, separate from Star Wars, just like what I found interesting at the time. And it was just a great match, and we went from there. And yeah, the rest is history.
And that is remarkably groundbreaking history, because I think what is beautiful about your work and other artists who appreciate the newness, and you can only piggyback and ape on what has been done before. I'm going to show you my phone. This is probably the entirety of the Star Wars Visions soundtrack. I am such a geek.
Oh.
I bought music to a animated TV show on Disney Plus. But there's something equally moving and equally new, and because it takes sort of a Japanese approach to it, it takes a solo instrument approach to it, and then it definitely does iterations on what Williams has done. But it's those things that do keep it fresh without feeling like certain franchises are just, okay, we're gonna do the same thing. We're not gonna do two cars, and now there's four cars or five robots. It's like just, amping up the formula that what was done before. But I mean, even the first track, I mean, there's like a jingling of keys. And I think on like a molecular level, I mean, I might be making this up in the first couple seconds, is are there Easter eggs or little subliminal playing in the sandbox thing where like this is about criminals, and so there's an element that feels like seedy, nefarious ways to make music, or things of that nature.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's sort of a psychoacoustic kind of idea at the very start. I knew that it was going to be a shooter, and then I also knew that the main character Kay Vess is she's all in it for the money, and so what I did was I took the two largest coins that I have. There's some Europe, I forget where they're from, but like European coins, drop them in midair to get this nice ping sound, and combine that with the sound of a gun cocking, the ch-ch-ch, kind of like that. And that's the sound that you hear right at the start. It was sort of just to try and get something that grabs your attention. It's like, whoa, what's going on this? But also has some sort of like narrative connection to the game itself and the story that it's trying to tell.
Well, it worked. I mean, wouldn't be here asking you the question if I didn't notice that. And I do get into incredibly granular, geeky levels. So I'm glad that even it wasn't a keys. I was on the right path. I wasn't too far off. Well, I think that the other beautiful thing about this is that, like you said, it's the first open world game in the Star Wars universe. And I remember this is piggybacking what you were saying. I remember speaking to Brian Tyler a long time ago. I said, "What's more difficult, writing movies or games?" And he goes, "Oh, games, because you have to create the eventualities that a character will encounter every step of the way." So, like you were talking about Monkey Island 2 and the way it timed out with how they exited a one of the shops. I remember there was a game called Eco Quest, where I imagine it was for the PC. It's where a boy finds his dad is an oceanographer, captures a dolphin. Dolphin can talk. Dolphin says, "Hey, we need to go down below the ocean. Help me find this our lost giant whale king." Like, incredibly high concept, a lot of fun. But he goes to each of the houses of these fish and marine mammals, goes into an angelfish's apartment, so to speak, and you've got jazz music. And then you go to another one, it's got like a funky Jamaican rhythm. And it was nice that you could take that, and whether it was a new theme or like a variation. And where I'm going with this is how much exploration or how much fun do you have to sort of, hey, we got our base theme. Now it's Now, if you're going to go to Canto Bight, it's got like a gambler theme to it, or how do you take it through this that paces when it's in a different setting?
It really depends on the title and on the developers and how much width they're willing to give to the soundtrack. So for something like Outlaws, it's pretty broad, which is what we really needed. I mean, actually, from the very start, as soon as they hired me, I said, "Thanks a bunch. I'm going to have a lot of fun with this, and we definitely need two other composers." From the very start, that was in the plan, because you go to so many different planets, and there's so many different criminal factions that if it were just my voice the entire game, I mean, I'm a pretty diverse composer, relatively speaking, but like even then, it would be such a bummer not to have like a completely different sound when you go to different planets like Akiva and Kijimi, which were scored by John Everest and Kazuma Jinulchi, respectively. And so that was important there. The opposite of it would be something like Call of Duty World War II, where we very intentionally had this like tightrope that we were walking, where it was like it couldn't be too modern, but it also couldn't sound too historical and stale. We had to make history, because this was historical fiction. We had to make history feel like it's happening right now. We had to make you feel like anything can happen to these characters. You're very much on edge. You are a part of this tale. But it couldn't sound so modern that you're just taken out of the historical context. So we had to be very specific about the kinds of, I mean, even down to like the chords and just individual notes. And certainly the instrumentation had to be like very precise with almost no leeway at all beyond what was established in the main theme, which is very difficult for me because I like to have a lot of diversity in my scores. I get quite bored when I'm not allowed to kind of, stretch my legs a little bit. Mortal Kombat is another instance where the instrumentation was quite diverse. That's maybe one of my favorite things about working on the Mortal Kombat franchise is just how much stylistic diversity that we're allowed because of the type of game and how there's always so many different societies and even realms in Mortal Kombat. One day I might be asked like, "Oh, give us like an action cue," and then the next day it's like, "Well, actually, I would like to incorporate a soul singer into this mix," and then the next day I'm like writing a ancient Greek ballad or something like that. There's always some kind of new, different thing to do within the Mortal Kombat universe in terms of music genre, but again, it always depends on the game and what the parameters of the game end up being.
We're gonna go right into Gundam Requiem for a Vengeance, 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 vengeance. Okay, so we're going from active gameplay to a passive narrative. So the music that you did for Gundam Requiem for a Vengeance is equally impacting. I love the compositions and what you did to make that so effective. But I wasn't sure if having come from a world where you do get to play in a sandbox and be so elaborate and do something in, let's say, 90 seconds to 2 minutes, is that more constrictive to you? Do you like working with a tighter runtime to make something effective? What is your approach?
Well, the interesting thing about working on Gundam, I was very intimidated at first for a plethora of reasons, not the least of which being Gundam is one of the most important IPs in all of Japan, and as you know, I'm so heavily influenced by Japanese video game and anime composers. Then add on to that that it's so big that many of my favorite composers from Japan have worked on a Gundam series. Ko Otani and Yoko Kanno, Kenji Kawai, Sawano-san, they've all done a Gundam series, and now it's like, all right, well, now it's your turn, first Westerner to ever be trusted with a Gundam score. Good luck, So it was terrifying in that regard. But also, I'd never done a mini series. I've never done like a fully professional, like high, blockbuster, shall we say, linear score. I've done a lot of indie projects over the years, indie film, but never anything this Never anything that would have this many eyes on it, never this level of notoriety. However, the interesting thing about working in linear as opposed to working on a game, particularly if it's of the sort that's like it's trying to take itself very seriously, is that it's kind of very luxurious in a way. I mean, almost all of my work on Mortal Kombat has been in the story modes. So like, yeah, I'll write the main theme, but then it's mostly the cutscenes, which go on for like hours and hours, except each individual cutscene has this very frantic timing to it. And especially in other games that I've scored, Star Wars Outlaws, where they do have cutscenes in addition to the in-game music, the timing is so fast that you rarely get a chance to kind of stretch out your legs and really explore a theme or a sound or a mood. It's just like, well, you got 20 seconds, so make the best of that because we're going to move on immediately after that in the edit. So once I really internalized that on Gundam, it became a much more fluent way of scoring. It became much more relaxed and just comfortable to, I could allow the music to sort of lead the scene rather than having to just react to every single second of like what happens here, what happens there. Even in the combat scenes, like the big robot fights or mobile suits or there's also boots on the ground fighting. Even there, the way that the edit worked was a lot more about the big picture rather than like you have to do this in 5 seconds and then this and then this and then keep going on. So in that regard, it was slightly easier in a certain way than working in games, because the edit is so much more relaxed and so much more big picture oriented. Whereas in a game cutscene, they're just like, this has to happen and then this, and then we get out of there because the players will skip the cutscene if we don't go too fast or whatever. So that was kind of the first main difference that I saw between working in games and working on Gundam.
Well, you mentioned something that was something I really wanted to speak to you about. There's two moments in episode three that are sort of breather moments. One's where they're driving through the country, and then there's another moment where it's like it allows you to create a sense of space, find a rhythm, and like you said, you're not reacting to a 5 second cut. And I just find those so impacting because it is. It establishes the mood, it helps inform character, even if nothing's being said. And so I just wanted to learn a little more about what your process was in those quieter moments.
Yeah, I mean, those were some of my favorite moments to score. It's interesting. Like, I got the script for Gundam Requiem back in 2021. And, obviously, animation just takes a long time, excuse me, to produce. And so, yeah, I had the first script back then. Obviously, they iterated on the script quite a bit since then. But I printed it out and was just taking notes on the margins every time that I thought music could have a place here. And by the time that I started scoring in earnest, which was, I think, the beginning of 2023 when I got some real footage, it was, I mean, I could make an entire album out of all of the tunes that I'd written just for moments like this, like that countryside drive or the convoy going around. I could write a whole album of it because that was just so obviously a place where music has the room to breathe. I think the hardest thing to do as a composer is to try to shove music in where it doesn't belong, where it's not needed. But when the edit or the scenery just screams music should come from here, it was so much easier to write. It should feel like music is emanating from the world, rather than I'm just like trying to shove music in, wherever it can fit. So yeah, those were some of my favorite moments as well to score.
That's great to hear. And the thing that I really there's two things. Let's go three. Let's talk about Perpetuum Mobile. There's something that when you were writing that theme, I often wonder if a composer writes with a theme in mind or a player in mind, because the way that the violin comes, you don't know until the show gets into full swing, that the violin is actually, it's integral to the story. As I forget the main character's name, but she was a concert violinist, as was her husband. And so it's like there's something to that. And I'm wondering, at a subliminal level, do you say, do I want a Hilary Hahn? Do I want an Itzhak Perlman? Or do I just write something beautiful and hope someone figures out what I'm trying to say? What is your mindset?
So the funny thing is that it actually didn't occur to me that people would make the connection that the main character is a violinist when I wrote the opening theme. I did know that the character was a violinist because one of the first things that I wrote was the Solari Violin Concerto. We knew early on that there was going to be a moment of like a flashback where she's, playing a violin concerto. So I wrote that in collaboration with the animation producer Hiroaki Yura, who, by the way, is a very well-known violinist and very accomplished, and he both recorded it and motion captured it for that scene
Oh, nice.
himself.
Did he have the
But
dress on too? Like, where the dress
he did
like
not
flows out into
know.
the stage?
As far
Okay.
as I know, he did not. I think that's just physics. But it's funny. Like all I thought when I was writing that piece, because they didn't give me any footage, I had no idea what it would look like. They just said, "Please write us a 90-second main theme this week," and just make it sound cool. And there's a certain other. I'm not going to say it, but there's a certain very famous television show that they were like, the intro is going to be kind of like this very like artistic kind of montage sort of thing, and quite slow and grandiose, and you got 5 days, go. And so what I thought was, okay, I want something to reflect the concept of new types. New types are sort of like this evolution of humanity that's very important to the Gundam franchise, where they have this ability to think on a higher level than us normal humans. And it's all about a new form of empathy that goes beyond anything that we can conceive of. And so my thought was, okay, I want to have some kind of a sound that establishes a key and that feels techy and scientific and brainy or whatever. And then the rest of the music will come in and completely thwart whatever you thought the key was. So that was literally how I began the piece, was like, I wanted to have this dichotomy. So it's like, here's like our human brains, and then here's this extra new type layer on top. So that's where the fast strings comes in. You don't actually hear it because of the way we mixed it, but it actually they keep playing throughout the entire piece, and it was very difficult to come up with like the counterpoint so that they could constantly have this like moving and interlocking solo strings line. But that was the idea behind it, was that I wanted this like higher level of thinking that establishes the, I don't know, E minor or whatever it is, and then the B minor comes in, and then it's this more emotional and broad kind of sound. Eventually I used the theme from that as the new types theme in the show. New type. Thankfully, I think I wrote the opening credits when I was about halfway through scoring the show itself. So I was able to incorporate it into later episodes because new types don't really become relevant until a little bit later. Anyway, but that was sort of the idea behind it. And then later on, one of the secrets that both film and game composers share is that we come up with the titles for our tracks like long after. I mean, some people start with a title and that inspires them, but usually it's like 1M3, it's like not actually, or in Mortal Kombat's case, it's just a series of numbers. We don't really have titles for these pieces until much, much later. And so when I was putting together the soundtrack edit, I was like, okay, what am I going to title the opening theme? I don't want it just to be called like Gundam Requiem opening theme. And I realized, like, well, actually, there is a, I wouldn't say a style, but there's like a term in classical music, perpetuum mobile, which means perpetual motion. And I was like, yes, this perfectly, I really lucked out because this like perfectly describes the piece that I'd already written. And then, of course, that you have like the allusion to the war being perpetual. That's always been a theme in Gundam, is that this war is going on for so long that we're fatigued. We can't believe that this conflict has lasted for as long as it has. And then, of course, the low-level pun of Mobile and Mobile Suit Gundam and all that. So I really just kind of lucked out with choosing that title. But that's my very long-winded explanation of that opening theme.
What other things do you maybe intentionally, not intentionally graft on based on your experience, the things you like, and say, hey, I've always wanted to take this thing here and put it here, and maybe I love this, let's infuse it.
Oh, every single piece I write has some sort of like a composerly intention, shall we say. I mean, usually it's more of an abstract thing like, wouldn't it be cool if I'd use harmony in a certain way? Or, you know, like, what if I somehow got like, you know, like these sort of more mathy sort of things that I find as an interesting inspiration. But certainly, I mean, I love the Metal Gear series. And, I think some of the more like espionage type stuff in both Gundam Requiem and in Outlaws do have some of that Metal Gear DNA. That's actually part of why I hired Kazuma for Outlaws, is because he has worked on Metal Gear 4 and Peace Walker. And so he, you know, I'd never scored stealth before. So I figured, like, okay, well, let's get someone who absolutely knows stealth music and have his help with, you know, making it sound legitimate. And he did. He did a beautiful job on all of his music for the Shiga clan and for Kijimi on Star Wars Outlaws. For Gundam, I think that part of why I was hired for the project was because and Hiroaki Yura, the animation producer, who's also the sound director, he was the one who hired me for this. And I think the reason why is because he knew that I had so much influence from Japanese composers from both anime and video games. And at the same time, I'm still very clearly a Western composer. And he wanted that fusion of the two cultures, because the whole point of this project, of the whole show, was to bring Gundam to a wider audience, while still respecting the Japanese roots and the heritage and not screwing it up. So they just made sure that, okay, we need to make sure that this music is going to appeal both to a Western audience and to a Japanese audience. The first thing he said was, you know, we really have to have powerful melodies. We couldn't necessarily do a more typical Hollywood thing where it's more about mood and texture. There really had to be themes for the characters, for the factions, for the Gundam, of course. And at the same time, it had to have that Western production style where we didn't do the typical anime thing where we just write a bunch of tracks and then a music editor will kind of slot them in here and there. But instead, it was spotted, you know, minute by minute. And I scored it like a film, essentially, instead of doing the sound menu style. So that was kind of our strategy to make sure that it would appeal to both types of audiences.
Well, I think your approach to hitting both target demographics, Japanese audiences who know this and love it, and American audiences who may not be up to speed, I'd say that 6 episodes are not enough. It sounds like there's more. It says season one as if it's under an un understated to be continued. So,
Yeah.
does the story go on, Mr. Roger?
Honestly, I wish I knew. I have no idea. I would love to continue. I mean, there's so much more. I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I say that there's like an entire second album worth of sketches and things that didn't make it into the show. But you know, I fell in love with the characters. You know, the actors, they did such a great job with bringing these characters to life. And you know, in working on Gundam, I ended up doing a ton of research on the franchise and watching a bunch of the shows, and I fell in love with that as well. So any opportunity to go back into the franchise, I would definitely say yes. But as of now, I have no idea what future plan, or even if there are future plans for this.
Well, if it's Netflix, I'm sure they're going to want more. So you're probably on their speed dial, maybe number two. But because your work thrills us 10 ways from Sunday, Wilbert, tell us, what are your 10 favorite things? Could be anything, professionally, personally, food-wise, shoes, anything. What are your 10 favorite things? Take us
10
out of this
favorite
interview.
things. What? I don't know. I love this bear. He's my kid brother. So he's probably number one. I love good coffee. When I visited Tokyo, oh, so yeah, one of the things about Hiro, in addition to being animation producer, sound director, former concert violinist, and all that, turns out he's also a big coffee fan. So he started a coffee business.
Oh, no way.
So when I was visiting, I got to check out some of their stuff, and I was like, man, this is so good. And then it turns out that he lives in like a part of, or not lives, but he works in a part of Tokyo where it's like you can't throw a brick without getting good coffee. And so, yeah, I loved that. Let's see, ramen as well. So another point for Tokyo. I guess Tokyo can probably be just a, somewhere on the list.
That'll be number four. We'll call it to the entirety of Edo, now Tokyo. We'll call that number four.
Yeah, I love fighting games. I mean, I've fallen a little bit out of practice as of late, but I loved like Virtua Fighter, Street Fighter 6 is incredible. And obviously Mortal Kombat back in the day. Those are my favorites. I love action adventures as well. I mean, Star Wars Outlaws has got to be my favorite game that I've ever worked on to like actually play. I'm still playing it now, and I'm at that point where it's like I know what happens, which kind of sucks. Is that's sort of the catch 22 about working on games, is that you know what happens, so it's not a
Yeah.
surprise. And like I've been delaying the inevitable so hardcore, but now that I'm like 60, 70 hours in, it's like, all right, I gotta finish the story now. And so I'm kind of on that third act rail where it's like, all right, let's go, you have to move on with the story. And Uncharted is probably one of my favorites, and of course Metal Gear. So working on Outlaws was like, oh, cool. So I get to do both Uncharted and Metal Gear at the same time. Like, freaking awesome. Let's see. I love so much scored music. I mean, Yoko Kanno is probably my favorite composer, which is a cheating answer because I mean she's basically like the brain of 10 different composers, if you think about it. Everything she writes is so different from everything else. But so many of her scores, from like Ghost in the Shell, I'm sorry, to Turn A Gundam, which is a very tough act to follow, Terror in Residence as well. I mean, so much great stuff across her career. Earth Girl, Arjuna. Let's see, what else? I've always been a fan, not so much anymore, but of the martial arts. That's kind of what got me into, or rather, Mortal Kombat is what got me into that. I was religiously watching Kung Fu movies as a kid. We had this one very bootleg radio or TV station in Philadelphia where I grew up, where I don't even understand what network it was, but it was like Channel 48, and you could barely get signal, and it was like it was so ghetto. I don't understand. It felt like it was like some guy's house that he was broadcasting a signal. I don't understand how this channel existed, but for some reason, every Saturday they would play, just nonstop Kung Fu movies, like the original 1970s bad dubbing, crazy sound effects Kung Fu movies for like 5 hours straight every Saturday. And I would just watch constantly. I mean, it was so cool. And then other like TV shows like WMAC Masters, which is a reference that no one will get, but it was a, if you imagine like a martial arts reality TV show hosted by Bruce Lee's daughter, Shannon Lee, that kind of played out like WWE, but with like different martial arts from around the world. One of the best shows ever that nobody remembers, but check it out. It's on YouTube a little bit. So there's that. What else? I mean, I used to love Japanese role-playing games a lot. Nowadays, I've kind of moved on to more of the action adventure stuff, but I mean, my entire apartment is like a shrine to Cloud Strife, basically. I have like, here's Cloud on his motorcycle for FF7 Remake, and my bedroom is just all wall scrolls everywhere of Final Fantasy VII. I have all these action figures. I got a Cloud action figure, but then I thought, oh, he's going to be so lonely alone. And then Crisis Core came out, so finally I got a Zack action figure that now Cloud and Zack are finally reunited. It's the lamest thing ever, but like I love FF7. That's sort of my world. And then From Software, I love Elden Ring and Bloodborne are definitely my two favorites. So, random story. I don't know what number we're up to now, but
We're
I'm
at 10, but
pretty.
we will go as long as you want. Give us a
Oh,
spell.
okay,
Give us
sure, yeah. So great. So we're done, but I do want to tell this story because this is actually kind of funny. I was working on Call of Duty World War II, and for that game, we actually did work with the Sony PlayStation music team. So they have a whole team of music editors and supervisors, mix engineers, and implementers. And as luck would have it, Sledgehammer Games, which is the developer of Call of Duty World War II, is practically across the street from their studio, from the Sony studio in San Mateo. So we took a little field trip over. And, this was Sony's first time working with Sledgehammer. So they're trying to kind of impress everyone or whatever. So they take us on a little tour. And on the floor right above the music studio is their model creator. So this is the person who creates all of the like models for I don't want to say action figures because it's not quite that, but like all of the specialty kind of things. And I just saw this really awesome Bloodborne model where it's like the hunter and he's defeating some townsperson who's been turned into a beast or whatever. It's just the coolest looking thing ever. And I was like, oh wow, that's so cool. You made this online. It's so neat. And the dude goes like, thanks. You want it? I was like, what? And then a week later, it just shows up in my apartment in Seattle. And so yeah, it's been proudly displayed ever since.
Holy cow. See, that is, when you make something special and you touch somebody's heart or their emotions with that and you make that connection, I mean, that's, oh, geez, that's, I should put that at the front of this podcast to let Mr. Roger, from the bottom of our hearts, the ends of our 3.5 millimeter cables, we have been astoundingly happy to talk to you about your professionalism, your output, your creative insights, and just your general well-being. So, everyone, check out Mr. Roger's work on the internet, on Netflix, MIDI. If you go to his website, he's got his bio in Japanese. That's how cool this cat is. He's a rodeo cat. He's gonna ride all day. So, Mr. Roger, thank you for your time, and we will catch you next time.
Yes, thank you for having me.